The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. All discussion is limited to publicly available information and should not be interpreted as legal, professional, or financial advice. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license nor provide any financial services. Before making investment decisions, you should obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rox from Ensemble, and I'm thrilled to be bringing to you the podcast Engine Room. It's devoted entirely to the practices or the business of financial advice. Over the course of the next many months, we're going to be interviewing Australia's best independent boutique advice firms, their practice managers, their GMs, on what environment is conducive to being a best practice, how they keep talent, how they attract talent, and what the future of financial advice is. It's the Engine Room Podcast. Welcome aboard.
If you're one of the many advisors who told us, I don't need another good idea, I need support to actually implement, then this is for you. We have launched Ensemble Progress, a professional development membership built for advisors who want momentum, not just inspiration. With protected time to implement, peer-led accountability, and practitioners sharing what's actually working, Ensemble Progress helps you turn intention into consistent, visible results. Instead of the important work getting pushed to next quarter, it gets done. Find out more at ensemble.com/membership.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rox, and welcome to yet another edition of The Engine Room. As we start a new year, we've got lots of possibilities. I'm in downtown Erina, which is in the central coast of New South Wales. It is a beautiful blue day, and I'm here with someone I've known for many, many years. A very friendly person who's going to have a rollicking good story for us for the next hour, Justin O'Donoghue. How are you, Justin?
Roxy, thanks very much for joining us and welcome to Erina.
Thanks, mate. And I've actually been to several of your offices over the years. And in fact, we physically met each other, even though we live about 40 Ks away from each other. We met each other where?
Met each other, I think it was around 2013 or 2014 in the Philippines. So we actually, you live very close to where our office was originally.
Yeah, I was near Hornsby, and we met because we were both very early adopters of outsourcing at the time, which back then was I think we didn't know what we were doing.
Absolutely, learn on the go.
but inherently we had nice people running nice practices, and I think that personality probably it gave us a bit of an insight. But you know, we were laughing then. I just had a quick squiz of your LinkedIn as my professional stalking. And, apart from the fact that you've got, a wonderful degree, which is a Bachelor of Commerce and Bachelor of Laws, and you got the Division for the Law Prize for Taxation, I imagine FASEA didn't like it enough.
Is that right? It's actually a really interesting story on FASEA. So when I was originally doing the qualifications or admission for the FASEA financial advisor qualification, they originally said I didn't have it. And so I sort of asked them some of those questions, and it turns out I had the tax practitioner qualification rather than the advisor qualification. So there was a little bit of a back and forth as we certified that I could provide tax advice.
Mate, if you're a dual degree, diploma of legal practice lawyer, division prize for taxation, and then you went on and I think did you end up getting your CA or CPA as well?
Chartered accountant, yep. So 10 years in taxation at KPMG. So great grounding there.
It's just hilarious. But first of all, very much you... These are serious degrees. This is Macquarie University down there in Sydney. What got you into financial planning?
Yeah, so I started the career for all my sins in taxation. Actually love taxation, a bit of a tax nerd. But yeah, so started in taxation and was working there for a number of years. And then Dad had a financial advice business.
Whereabouts was that?
In Hornsby, yep. So he had that business. He'd run it for around about 10-15 years by that point.
So you grew up a little bit with it when you're in your high school?
So I'd had that exposure, but I actually never wanted to go into it, believe it or not. And Dad had some health issues. So there was some sort of sudden health issues and some, not some so great news there. And so I basically came into advice originally to look after the business while Dad had treatment. And years later, still here.
There you go. Very noble start, but... The real exciting thing on LinkedIn is that you did a secondment in KPMG Mexico.
Yeah.
Tell me all about that.
The tequila train. Yes. No. Look, that was an amazing experience. So the ability to immerse yourself in another jurisdiction for 3 months, not speaking the language, learning, the local approach to things, you know, the interaction with the US tax system was quite an interesting experience.
Well, I'll ask you a question. So that was in the early noughties, and we had had at the time, that was actually in, yeah, no, 2010 or 11. That's it. Yeah, 2010.
I'm not that old.
Sorry. Sorry, Justin. That's, sorry, manifesting myself on you. Apologies. So 2011. So we had had 15 years of compulsory super or thereabouts in Australia, and you got to look at the US one. I don't get this opportunity very often. So when you compare the pair, what are the positives and negatives of us?
Look, the compulsory element for Australia is ultimately a great outcome. So that longevity and the ability for everyone to share in that. I mean, the US 401k system and some of the, you know, retirement savings schemes there, it is very skewed. There is...
Towards what?
It's skewed towards more wealthy individuals. And so the whole system is not as equal and fair as the Australian system tends to be. And I don't think that's just restricted to the retirement arrangements in the US. There's other parts of like the Medicare systems and those types of pieces, which, you know, create some challenges.
What an interesting, you've just sown a great seed for later on in this podcast. It kind of, what you're saying is the 401k in America help rich people get richer. And I feel that the way in which financial planners have been legislated the last sort of 7 to 10 years at least has pushed financial planners making wealthy people wealthier, except your role now as head of operations and excellence and indeed head of best practice is trying in your own way to remedy or sort of answer that question. Is that right?
Absolutely. And look, I don't think it's unfortunately just retirement savings where these things exist. You know, if you look at some of the tax rules and how they are applied, it makes it very hard for a number of people to actually execute. But yeah, so in terms of my current role as head of advice operations, so it's that ability to be able to provide advice to all Australians, not just wealthy Australians.
That would have been the vision that your father no doubt had in his practice. And when you came in, so you came into that practice in 2012.
2012, yeah.
Thrown in, you know, kind of, well, not really at the deep end. It was your father. You needed to do it. But as far as knowledge around sitting down with clients, I mean, did you go directly into client meetings? Was it that abrupt?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I went from, you know, a several billion dollar transaction the months before I left KPMG to sitting with mums and dads after that. And it's an amazing transition. So, I mean, you know, I was a very unique opportunity to be able to spend, you know, more than a decade working with my father. You know, not many people get the opportunity to spend that time with their parents day to day. It was fantastic.
Ensemble Progress is for advisors who want real momentum, not just inspiration. Find out more at ensemble.com/membership.
And he would have really appreciated it. I mean, if the illness was a catalyst to come in, to then have 10 years to, you know, really quality years, and to work with you. And when I met you was in 2014-15, you'd already taken the a real sort of lateral thinking approach. And I suppose that is your background. You know, you were never trained as a planner. You went into, you know, large businesses. You're highly educated. And when you looked at your financial planning advice practice, I always sort of associated with quite innovative. You were early adopters of UX with, you know, the client experience was very important to you. At what stage did you, you know, take over the day-to-day running of that business, which was Vintage Wealth, everyone?
Yeah. So, look, it would have been probably mid-2010s, so 2015, 2016, that sort of started to shift. And, you know, as a lot of advisors are going through, you know, Dad was getting closer to retirement, looking at how he steps away and is able to enjoy not just the fruits of his labor, but, you know, all that advice that he'd given to everyone else and how he sort of takes that advice on board himself.
That's right. And what was the scale of your business?
Yeah, so we weren't a massive business. We had four advisors, you know, a number of admin support, and we had a number of offshore team members as well in Cebu there.
But it was also, you were based in Hornsby, but you had businesses in Cessnock, I believe.
Yeah, Cessnock and Bankstown.
Forbes and Bankstown. And,
yep.
And you did do a bit of time on the road. And was they businesses that you had acquired or how did you end up with that geographic footprint?
Yeah, so a number of them were through acquisitions. And, you know, and I'm sure we'll touch on this a bit later, but, you know, we did four acquisitions as a Vintage business. And, you know, obviously there's been a number of acquisitions there as well. So, you know, I think that's been a hallmark of financial advice over the last, you know, decade in particular.
And in your time at your practice, maybe give us a few of the successful innovations that you implemented at Vintage. And what were some of the learnings that some of the listeners might be able to really take from this?
Yeah, the successful ones often are also the failures in the beginning. So even with the VBP piece, so the outsourcing initially, you know, there were a lot of, you know, false starts and areas where we needed to improve that. But it also became a key cornerstone of our business. You know, those team members, we had one of our team members for 8 years there, right? So, you know, you build the longevity, you build the relationship over time. And it was about how do you learn from the bits you don't necessarily do correctly to begin with. So it might be that you didn't necessarily dedicate enough time or the right resourcing to getting the fundamentals in place. So you ended up band-aiding solutions later on rather than fixing root cause, those types of things.
And in your business, given that you were client-facing, did you also straddle the role of like general manager as well or operations?
Yeah. And look, very fortunate with my father in the business. We shared the business responsibilities. So we would allocate that between us, you know, play to our strengths and use that to actually run the business. We had a very, you know, open relationship. We were able to challenge each other's ideas. And that's been something that I really value from a business perspective. You know, it probably comes from the law degree background, that adversarial system concept. You know, I think that really does apply in what we do day to day.
And a bit of lateral thinking as well. And you were part of the AMP Advice Network. Were you a Hillross from memory or no?
No, we were AMP AFD. Yeah. And we went down the AMP Advice path, so the Golf 360.
Okay, so I've come out to your office and I think at the time when they did the Coles 360, it was very much conceptually the antidote to really dry SOAs. Mm-hmm. But I suppose it just struggled in the implementation. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. So the concept, you know, in many respects is really sound.
Yeah. Right? And it still sounds.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
For everyone listening, that's the concept of a live, dynamic, electronically driven building of a portfolio literally in front of the client.
Correct. And linking it back to those values and goals. Mm. You know, that underpins everything we do. And so the ability to develop that life with the client was a really powerful proposition. As you sort of rightly flagged, it was the execution of some of the outworkings of that became a challenge.
I think like a lot of things, the technology and legislation was probably not lockstep with the what the consumer has desires. It still isn't, right? And we're sort of in your current role. This is your everyday challenge, I imagine. What the consumer wants, what we want to deliver, and how can we do it? And that triangle's tough.
And as a values-driven organization, it is so important to bring that into the advice we deliver. You know, there's been that marked professionalism across the advice industry, and you don't want to see it slip back into a product-focused, you know, outcome.
So outside of work, so and you mentioned, so you went into the business when your father was ill at the time. But sounds like, you know, you managed that up until, when did you make the decision to a succession plan? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned there, maybe your backstory, you've got a partner and you've got kids, but maybe how old are your children?
Yeah, so my oldest is 12, my middle child's 10 and my youngest is 8, so.
So all the listeners, he's in that zone. He's in that zone. So the last 10 years, I don't know if you had any spare time. The next 10, you got no spare money. So you've been
the teenage years. I might want to do a bit of travel.
You're away from them with your wife. Absolutely. Shout out to my children, although I'm hoping they don't listen. God love them. So you've sat down there. The stakeholders in your business.
Yep.
A business that you know, although you mentioned it was small, the average advisor has one or two advisors. So, you know, your business was 2 to 3 times the size of the normal, the median advice practice. And you've gone, well, what were your thoughts? Should I borrow money and buy that out? Should I bring in a partner? Well, take us through. I want to learn the decisioning that you went through.
So from a decision, we sat down and we, you know, Dad obviously wanted to be able to step back at some point. You know, I think like most advisors, and particularly most founding advisors, you know, they want to make sure the legacy is looked after as well. And so we started looking at the options. And the first option was for me to buy him out. And, you know, it was a viable financial outcome or a financial option. But from a practical perspective, coming back to my comment earlier around that, you know, belief in the adversarial system, those types of things, you know, I actually don't feel that a single owner business gets the best outcomes. So as much as you can try and as much as you can put the effort into empowering your team, there is that power dynamic that sits there. And so being able to overcome that power dynamic so that employees and team members can really speak their mind, that's really challenging.
Do you have any examples of where that happened to you? You look back there and you go, geez, I wish they told me no.
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. Look, I tend to get excited. So it's the person to be able to hold you back a little bit. So, you know, you go away to a conference or you go away to a session, you come back with all these brilliant ideas. You're like, yep, great, want to get cracking. Let's do it tomorrow. Sometimes you need someone to step back and go, Justin, crazy idea, but let's just think about it that fraction more, right? And so that's a, you know, probably a really good example. Whereas team members tend to go, yep, we'll support you. You own the business, yet we're there for you. That business owner dynamic is really powerful to go, Justin, let's just think, work out how do we actually implement this.
Yep. 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 And so part of your thinking was if I just bought out and here I am, I'm in the same echo chamber, you know, one of your superpowers is your ideas and your innovation. And I suppose part of your subconscious is you're looking for a couple of other partners who might be the counter to that.
Yep.
Might be the more circumspect, the more sort of taking things and breaking them down. But you had a good quality business, a great lineage. You had, you know, multiple offices. Was it them coming to you or you coming to them? And
yes,
and yeah. I mean, I know when. Maybe we can give the context of the bit that appealed to you, okay, and then we can go on the journey of what happened next because the Pandora's box has opened up.
Yeah, so InvestBlue did originally approach us for a different piece of work, and to be frank, the answer was no, right? So it was nope, not interested. And at that time, it was you're just a corporate, don't really want to go down that path, you know, that founder's legacy type concept. We didn't want to burn that. And then Steve and Ben, both of you guys probably will be potential interviewees for these sort of things. So came to us and said, guys, just at least have a think about this, right? And we went, okay, we investigate a little bit more. And long story short, the appeal was that regional focus. So we were a regionally focused business. And so that it was born out of Armidale and it had the desire to be able to be in every town or city with more than 50,000 people, that really appealed to us.
Why? What? So yeah. Regional's a sticker. What does that mean? What's the difference between a regional relationship with their advice practice and a city one?
It's the relationship. So the relationship tends to be much less transactional and it is focused around how you can embed and support that person both within their family unit but within their community. And that really, that meant a lot to us.
Let's articulate that, especially the community bit. My background was I was from a small country town and everyone knew everything. And what you did in your business life translated into how people spoke to you on the street. When I came to Sydney, I could go 3 months without seeing a client. I actually loved it. You know, it was because it was such a, you know, socially, you know, you kind of, but when that regional, especially those founders, they're very much, well, when I sell my practice after 30 years in a community of which I've probably sponsored the netball and the soccer and the swimming and all these sorts of things, I'm really conscious that if I had a big corporate come in, it might work for me, but it might not work for my people.
And it's the willingness to invest in the community, not just, you know, the netball team and those sort of things, but time. So, you know, a number of the large institutions have pulled back from regional support and regional involvement. So everything is via Teams or video call and you lose that human connection element. And so as, you know, and when you first go into some of these communities, and particularly if you're not based there, but you're regularly going there, you know, people kind of assume, oh, you're not going to turn up again tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you do it each time, every time, you become part of that community. You know, you can go to the coffee shop and run into people, which as you flagged, has its challenges at times, but you show your commitment to it.
Absolutely. So you eventually did take the leap.
Yep.
When was that?
May 2023, we officially moved across.
And what were the two or three bullet points that you and your father and your other stakeholders had that were non-negotiables?
So the clients. So we needed to make sure that the clients would continue to be looked after. So that they would continue to get that personalized service, that values-driven service that we really did hold dear.
Yep.
We didn't come from a strict sales environment. We came from an environment where if you do right by the client, good things will happen long term. And we wanted to make sure that philosophy was continued. We also wanted to make sure our team was looked after, that they were presented with the opportunities. So one of the challenges of the smaller organizations is people reach points in their career where they want to go further. And this provided people those opportunities to go into different parts of the business. I mean, we've had, as I said, team members for us post our change become, team managers for the sites that they're working in, those types of things.
And indeed your own journey, which we'll spend some time on. And I've known the guys socially for many years. There are off the website, 130 advisors, 30 locations. They've got 452 people working in the group. And I won't steal David Stevens' thunder, but a lot of them are owners of the business or aspirational owners of the business, which is an interesting piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. It's that ability to, a smaller share of a bigger pie and also having a broader engagement. So it's not just advisors who are owners in our business.
Absolutely.
And it's not just advisors who are leaders in our business.
Yeah, I've always found that with the group. And it's been part of the secret sauce is that it takes a village to raise a child, but it also takes an entire business to help a client. And the advisor is one part of that. So that kind of scale of a business, well, that's a way bigger than the one you've got. What was your fears?
So one of the benefits of a smaller business is if you make a change, if things don't go exactly as you anticipate, it's very easy to reverse that change. But when you make a change in an organization with 400 plus team members, that change is very hard to undo at times. And also, where if an error or an issue arises, that error is multiplied however many times across however many clients.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And what was the, so the I suppose the traditional merger or an acquisition is you've got a period of time for a handover. Yep. What was the period of time that was in that you negotiated and how did that pan out?
Yeah, so we had a 12-month transition period, but we ended up going early. In terms of things like, IT cutovers and system changes and those types of things, even though we were in things like earnouts and all those types of pieces, we actually went early, right? Because we were aligned to the philosophies. We had a very similar way of approaching client engagement. We had similar process components behind the scenes in terms of how early we started reaching out to clients, those types of things from an annual advice and service agreement perspective. Yeah.
Having those core tethers, married up with critical numbers, married up with sort of big, hairy, audacious goals, creates a sort of an intangible framework for success.
And it's also like there's other philosophies that sit behind the thing. So one of the big things internally is autopsies without blame.
Ooh.
Yeah, which I really love as a concept.
Right. Well, this is a finance-based podcast, but you the murder one so well. So if we could talk more about autopsies, this algorithm might spin me up to the top of the chart. So what does that mean?
Yeah. So it's that ability to look at challenges that have arisen, to be able to assess the underlying why behind those challenges, and as a team, come up with solutions and alternatives, which will actually either prevent it from happening or reduce impact or whatever it might need to be for that particular piece. But it's not about the person who did it or the people who were involved. It's about understanding the real why. And that's a really big fundamental shift, because what it does is instead of people being worried when an issue or an error occurs, they're more open to be able to discuss and identify it so that we can solve for the future.
Do you think that also being either the democratization of ownership does give agency?
And accountability.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, both sides of that one sword. You're right.
And probably the other word is, as shareholders, they're owners.
Yeah, that's right. So they've got an owner's mentality to problem solving, and if the why is hard, they've actually got that little bit of energy to try and solve it. Given that that's been your passion point, when you moved in and you brought forward some of those changes you mentioned, At what stage did they go, this guy actually knows a bit of stuff that we could use across the 14,500 clients that we've got, not just the sort of 500 or 600 clients that Vintage had, who I'm speculating. And how did that play out? Was that something obvious to you that you were desirous of?
Yeah, so I know it was quite open when we came across in terms of, you know, looking for those challenges to build something and have an impact at scale. And so, you know, at the end of our transition period, I became a team manager locally here and then did that role for a brief period and then went into the financial advice leadership team working with, our fantastic Cebu team over in Cebu there, and then have recently transitioned into the sort of wealth tech space, working with our process improvement team, our developing team around how do we create a system, process, and tech stack that delivers to the user and then ultimately delivers to our clients, because that's ultimately what we're here for.
System, process, wealth stack. Yep.
So we've had a Salesforce-based tool for a number of years now. We have an Xplan component sitting behind that as well. Yes. And you know, we've had several instances of Salesforce as well along that journey.
Right. Okay. And where does it sit down?
So now we have our own instance. So we have, you know, a significant amount of control and flexibility around how we build our CRM and how it engages with the other tools that we use. And so we're continuing to try and build that out. And, you know, you talked about, thinking forward around technology, you know, there are limitations around some technology. And, you know, if we tried to do some of these things 3 years ago, we probably couldn't have.
So if I'm an InvestBlue advisor, I'm coming in Salesforce. Typically, I've come not from Salesforce. If I've come from the incumbent AMP or network, whether it be Hillross AMP or Charter, indeed, it's been, I think, an Xplan or something.
Yeah, so a mixture of Xplan, yeah. But some of them would have had, there was a system called Clyde Hub.
That's it.
Which was a Salesforce-based.
Yeah. That was an AMP-based one.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So they've got kind of used to that. And with all that in mind, what's the avatar of an end client? I mean, you've talked up the fact that they're regional, that they're community-based, but does that predicate the client or are they coming all walks in life?
Well, as you flagged, 30-plus offices. So we have a very broad range of clients. Now, if I go back to my Vintage days, as a small practice, you know, it's very hard to really service such a broad group of clients because we had 4 advisors. So there's a limitation of skill set and capacity, right? Across 30 offices, we are able to service a broad client base because we're able to have specialties within our business, whether it's individuals with less complex needs, you know, your more traditional, you know, mum and dad, you know, small business type clients through to, you know, our private wealth groups. And we're able to sort of deploy the, you know, the right resourcing to the right locations as needed.
Am I right in saying that those 30 locations have been a combination of quite a few of them have been businesses that have done exactly what you've done over the last 10, 15 years. It's predominantly a eastern states business. It's a lot of locations in regional New South Wales, Queensland. But you've over the last 5 or 6 years, and I probably might be wrong, you've got Victoria, Canberra, and a Tasmanian one. And I believe that sort of a high net worth one is definitely solving a problem. I mean, every practice, including my own, 3% of the clients might come in. And they're probably someone's uncle. So you're looking after mum and dad. They've got, 700,000 to 1.2 million in assets. And then someone's brother's sold something and it's got 30 million. And you pretend you know what you're doing, right? And
yep.
And the smart people worked out they couldn't do it. And then the other people worked out over time that they kind of didn't have the tools. So how does it work where I've got that client and I'm in Albury Wodonga, for instance? She's picking alphabetized. You've got an alphabetized client list. Zetland doesn't get much. I've identified that client. And what's the logical process to get help?
And look, so I'll go back to one of your points about the uncle gets $30 million, you know, I'll do this. And you go, great, I've got a client that's worth X thousand dollars a year, right? But you don't necessarily take into account the amount of work, time, and effort it takes to actually service that. And so where you've got a client that's outside your process and efficiency, it's actually more costly to deliver that. So you're better off servicing your core group than you are necessarily servicing that outlier, right? So internally, as I said, we have the ability within our private wealth piece to deliver a private wealth offering, right? So it is the systems and processes are built to enable that delivery. So once again, you know, if you're in Albury, you might get the guys from Melbourne to come out to Albury and look after and work with that, you know, uncle that's inherited the money.
Yeah, that's right. And also with you've got the title of best practice lead, or you're running that. So what's your utopia for a best practice experience? So and Kira's looking to be going, I guess I'll be editing this out if he doesn't want it.
Look, for me, when I think about process development and experience, it's what's the client experience we want? What's the user experience? And then how does the technology support that?
So let's break that down. You mentioned the client experience, the user experience, and the technology framework. Just in your own words, what do you see as a sort of a utopian client experience, Justin?
So for us, it's very much values driven. So as we've spoken about in the past, you know, clients don't wake up going, let's talk about super consolidation, or let's talk about recontribution strategies. And, you know, as a technical guy, right, you know, coming from the KPMG world, that's what I thought clients wanted.
Yeah, you were like, TTR is my friend.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I'd gone from sitting in, you know, in a consulting space with, you know, tax managers and tax leaders from businesses, and that, you know, we talk about legislation, you're sitting around with a client.
Ladies, he's taken.
I know that the tax nerd comes out in me. But you're sitting with a client and you're talking about this particular part of the legislation or the CIS Act, and they glaze over.
Yeah.
And the other bit that was quite interesting in that was when you get nervous, right, as a new advisor, you go to your safe space. My safe space was technical, and that, you know, that didn't resonate. Right. So for me, the client and that value driven component is really, really important. Right. So we start with that and say, what is the value? What are the values of the client? What matters to them? And then how does that translate into their goals?
And question without notice, what are some of the unusual values that people said and you went, oh, that makes sense, but I never would have thought of that?
So for me, it's not so much the value difference there, it's the difference around what people select as the value versus what their goals and behaviors demonstrate.
Okay, so prioritizing and matching it up with reality.
Well, the example I'll use here, and excuse the language here for a moment, the importance of family. So everyone will select family is important to them, because if you don't, well, you're not a decent person, right? But when you look at goals and behaviors, the question is, do they demonstrate that underlying value? So that values discussion is not just a surface level discussion. It's something that should evolve based on the goals and the behaviors and the strategies that they actually want to apply. So it's a really iterative process, that value and goals discussion.
And that, so the client experience has to be tethered to their values, and almost just, you know, extracting out what their genuine, not their stereotypical values are. And that's the art, the soft skills. That's the soft skills in the interview, which I'm telling you, the feedback that I'm getting is that COVID didn't help teaching the next generation soft skills.
No, and the other bit is, you know, technology is not the panacea of all solutions, right? Technology is a tool that enables. And the secret sauce is how you align the technology or tool with the client discussion and engagement.
100%. And if technology was a solution, Robo advice, which came out 25 years ago, would have rendered all of us unemployed.
Well,
and it hasn't at all.
If you go back before that, the self-help books or the diet book, or, you know, you can read what needs to happen.
Yep.
It's the behavior and what the actions are that actually matter.
So being passionate about the client base is one, but what about the users? The users are all the stakeholders, whether they be the front-end advice, I met a couple of your charming client service managers today. You know, is that what you mean by users?
Correct. So what we need to do is make sure that we create a great user, a client experience.
Yep.
We go, fantastic. But if it's so clunky for a user or an advisor or a relationship manager or a, you know, one of our offshore team to actually do the process, two things will happen. Either we won't be able to deliver to our client experience that we want to do, or we'll have disengaged team members, which, you know, doesn't create a longevity in terms of the business. It doesn't help us in terms of relationship engagement with clients. So from a practical perspective, it's about making sure that our system and process delivers the experience for our team, which allows our team to deliver the experience to the client.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those playing along at home, disengaged team members means presenteeism, and presenteeism means your EBIT goes south. So that's the, and then the tech, right? So I like the fact that you don't start at the tech and then figure out what it can do for the client experience. You start at the client experience, you then go the user experience, and then you do the tech. And is that so? Right now, the tech stack, is it static, or is it has it embraced the next generation of potential agentic?
Yeah, so we're in a transition phase.
We always are in.
Yeah, and it should be.
Yeah,
right. This is not I get there and it's a finished journey. You know, tick that off and I move on to something else. It is something that you should continue to review and evaluate. So we are using things like, you know, Claris, which I understand has been on a number of the technology podcasts in the past. So we've used Claris internally.
Yeah.
Right. We've used Otter previously.
Otter AI. There you go. Yep.
So, you know, so those tools, we are looking at how we embed those within the business. But coming back to my...
Just pop them in the links, can you, Kieran? Just those two. We've done it before, but repetition drives the sales, someone once told me.
And look, the reality here, when we were a three-person or four-advisor business, it was much easier to put the technology into play. And if things didn't quite pan out as we expected, we could try and shift and pivot quite quickly. But with 100-plus advisors, it's hard to do the change management component. So there's a whole change management process when you're trying to get 100 advisors to use a system consistently in a process. You know, you have to go, we use an ADCAR model internally around change management, right? And being able to deliver that and have the confidence that what we're delivering isn't going to change tomorrow.
There's a profound statement on the website. This is a client-facing website, and it says, big enough to deliver, small enough to care. But I would say that you're also of the belief that's the case for the users. It's big enough to be able to deliver, but not institutional enough to be completely working in a sort of a soundproof box and not getting feedback.
Absolutely. And like, we are far from perfect, right? There is massive opportunities for us to continue to improve and engage. You know, we actively seek external, you know, reviews and support. You know, we've recently conducted reviews of our process and technology components and our, you know, high performance leadership frameworks to look for improvements in areas of opportunity. And it's really interesting reading those reports, because you kind of go, oh, things are quite negative, right? But the reality is, you're paying someone to find areas of opportunity. You're not paying them to go, you guys are doing great, right? You're paying them to go, where can we keep getting better? And then it's about, how do we then deliver on those recommendations or suggestions?
So with your role now, where does that take you? Do you here, or are you at the coalface and you're on the road? I mean, you don't mind being on the road. You've had businesses all around. But yeah, so how do you get, because when was the last time that you did a client-facing financial plan yourself?
So I did a meeting. No, far from it. I did one this week.
Oh, there you go. Right, there you go. So you're still keeping your hand in.
Yeah. Yeah, and there is a slightly dangerous position to be in, right? Where you go, I'm seeing one client here and there, therefore I'm still an advisor. I get to do everything. You know, I know exactly what it's like.
Sample versus population for the mathematicians at home. That's a maths joke.
But if you start to believe that too much, especially if you're in a leadership role where there might be support or people make things happen.
Yeah.
Right? And so what you need to do is you need to be out there and engaging with the teams and understanding what the real challenges people are facing. And once again, internally, we do things like, you know, innovation groups where we actually engage with, you know, active and vocal members of our team to get their feedback. And it's important. We don't just do that for advisors, right?
How long have you been in that role?
So I've been in the role for coming up on 9 months.
And were there any quick wins, or is it now just a iteration after iteration?
Look, there are quick wins. There's things that we look at in the process where, you know, it was done for a reason at the time, but that reason's changed. So it might have been we thought a system was doing something and it's not, and therefore we haven't necessarily started a process when we should, right? It's questioning some of those. So those are really quick wins. But once again, a lot of the real long-term benefits come from those strategic changes. So things like, you know, support functions. So one of our goals is to be able to assist, you know, more than 60,000 families.
Yeah, that's right? Big, isn't it?
Which is a big goal. Mm. But if you're in our development team or our process team, the question is, you know, how do you align to that, right? Is your goal, well, I'm going to build a better CRM, or I'm going to deliver a more efficient process? The answer is no. your goal is the same goal as everyone else, whether it's advice and client facing or you're in a support role. It's about how do we deliver that? And the other bit is, you know, you'll notice on the website, it's to deliver great advice. Now, it's a really big distinction here. It's not good advice. It's great advice, right? So it's taking that values, goals-driven advice and being able to deliver that holistically to a client. And our support teams need to think about that when we're thinking about process development or technology solutions. Because, you know, if we don't embed those into our process and technology, it makes it very hard to deliver that consistently across 100 plus advisors.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm just going to change gears now and talk about support teams. And although you had your own back office support team at VBP like I did, I think with David, Jennifer Morgan, and a bunch of people that have been part of the delivery team there have built a significant number of people. What's the and it's very rare that I get to ask questions to someone who's a bigger client than I am. So with
180
people working as your engine room within an engine room, oh, I've got people listening to this now that are wondering how they can manage their two. Okay. And they're thinking it's, but at one stage you guys were two, right?
Correct.
So what are the couple of sort of quick bullet points that it does with their team offshore? Okay. And this could be for people listening, this could be VBP, but it could be anyone.
Yep.
Right. What are a couple of things that it does that you think they got right?
So connection. So we had three team members from a vintage side, and we probably didn't necessarily create as much connection as we probably could have.
You didn't have the bandwidth, mate. Look, it's hard.
We didn't, but as you know, I mentioned in our pre-chat that, you know, we had one of our team members for 8 years. Like she was one, I think she was employee number 9.
Yeah, wow.
At VBP, and she was fantastic. And we had that deep connection with her. But with some of our newer team members, when that had changed, we hadn't necessarily built that connection. I was in Cebu in August last year and, you know, caught up with the team there, and we had 180 people at our town hall there. You know, we played games and that type. It's that connection to the business and the underlying outcomes that business is delivering. So coming back to the delivering to 60,000 families, we connect our team to that goal as well. And that's across all of the areas that our offshore team looks after. So our offshore team are not just doing admin for teams. We've got paraplanning. We've got back office support in our marketing, our HR, our finance functions.
Yeah, those last three, I also have. And people sometimes think that you can only get assistance in advice production. But marketing's marketing. Provided that you've got good core values and you've got a leadership, it's great. Finance is just numbers and tax. Learning tax is quite transferable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you talked about agentic AI and those types of things. You know, you can learn the tax legislation.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And when you, let's articulate another question. At the moment, your advice process for your network of planners, client comes in and they've got, how long does it take to get a doc? How long does it take for the turnaround to then be in a position to give the advice?
Yeah, and that's something we're continuing to work on.
Yeah.
Because it isn't something that's at a level we want it to be at this point.
Everyone says that.
Yeah.
But given that you've got so many, you kind of, we're taking out whether someone's really fast because you've got that many, it's a decent average, right?
So you're looking at somewhere between sort of 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
That turnaround.
And what do you think the client wants?
The client wants within 2 weeks.
Yeah, they do.
Like the reality of it.
Yeah.
You know, they're thinking about that issue at the time.
Yeah. Or there's been an event.
Correct.
Mm.
And they want a solution.
Mm.
And so that ability to pull it down, that's something we've been actively working on.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're doing a number of pilots and trials to work out areas that we can actually bring that in.
And you mentioned having specialization within skill set in the business. You know, I always bring this topic up because it is a part of the investment or the financial advice framework that you've got lots of clients. Is there a strategy?
Yeah, so we've built out a wealth protection team internally, so with some dedicated wealth protection advisors.
So I'm an advisor, and the topic of life insurance comes up. I then can I get tools from that person to do the job, or do I refer the client internally?
So we've got functionality for both.
Right.
Right. So that, you know, the ability to bring scale to it, we can leverage the skills of the individuals. Now, whether that's delivered through the advisor or delivered by the team, there is some of that flexibility that's built in to what we do.
And where's that based?
So it's quite spread out. So, you know, we've got team members in the Hunter. We've got team members down in Victoria. So it's building out that we've got some in Armidale in our wealth protection team. So it is a broad group that gives us that coverage because, as I said, you know, it is challenging to have a wealth protection specialist in every office.
Oh, absolutely. And it's all part of it because you do need specialist ability to place insurance. You need really, really specialist ability when the claim time happens.
Absolutely.
And you've got to have these other skills, which in a subscale business is quite difficult to master.
And especially to be across the variations between providers. And so, as I said, as an individual advisor in a one or two person practice, it is hard to stay across all of that. Plus, you know, the wealth management side and the super rule changes and all those types of things. So you can't be a master of everything.
Absolutely. And if we go back to your BHAG, and you don't have to steal the thunder of the visionaries within this business, but you've got 15,000 odd clients retained now. I think, did you mention 50 or 60,000? Is that right?
So the goal is 60,000.
Yeah. So we're looking to get quadruple the number of clients. Do you see the role of technology impacting the ability to do that? Because if you have four times the advisors, that's sort of 700 advisors. I just can't see, that's a lot of advisors. There's not that many joining the industry.
Absolutely.
So what's tech going to do? Like, and the million-dollar question, probably the billion-dollar question with regards to this company is, how do we genuinely get those advisors from looking after 100 families to 200-300? Like, that's it.
Ultimately, it's got to be an enablement tool.
Yep.
Right? So it's about how does technology enable capacity? Because as you rightly pointed out, you know, 700 advisors, that's fantastic. But if you look at the overall advisor numbers, that's a significant portion of the overall market.
Mate, we could colonize Mars before you organically grow 800 advisors in 5 to 7 years, as much as we'd love to do that. And look, Ensemble is probably one of the best vehicles to do it. And you know, good work by the team at Striver there, bringing people through. But yeah, no, enablement here.
Absolutely. But it's also, so technology is one, you know, string in that bow. It's also things like process. So questioning in the process, why are we doing something? You know, there's a number of steps in our current journeys, both across Vintage and across, you know, many advice businesses that are done just because we've always done it that way. And so being able to challenge that status quo a little bit is really, really critical because there's a number of things I think we can take out that does chew up capacity.
Oh, and just to sort of exacerbate that, every year you're bringing in new businesses. So the change management piece, you've got to change people's hearts and minds before you change their tech, because you do it the other way around, it just sometimes accelerates bad behavior or resentment.
Correct. And because of the scale element, you almost want to do a dual track approach. So there's quick wins and savings. So, you know, if we save 10 minutes per client across the, you know, 12, 15,000 clients, that's a big impact, right? That has a material impact long term. But is it the solution to capacity constraints? No. So you need to be thinking about it both from a current user experience, but also where is the technology and solutions going to be in 3, 6, 12, 24 months? Because we need to build for that as well.
Let's talk AI for a second. I mean, we spoke off mic and what my other business is looking to do. And my hot take is the fact that it's far less sexy than what you think. And if you treat it as a miracle cure, you're just going to be let down. It's actually quite grimy. And if you actually get the robotic process automation is actually the linchpin. What's your group doing?
Yep.
And how far along are you in that process? And for your division, what's the goal? Is it saving the 10 minutes here and there? Is it saving the CapEx or the OpEx per deal? What's a good day look like for you?
Yeah. So in terms of our journey, so we have not had a lot of success on RPA to start with.
It's hard.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And there's lots of learnings you get from that. So going back to my comment earlier, autopsies without blame, right? It's not about the person. It's about what could we have done differently? So we, you know, at our organization level, it's did we have the right resourcing allocated to it? You know, it is grimy. You need to be in the detail. You know, this is moving X to Y or logging into here and doing this action, right? It's very micro. And you need to make sure you've got the right people doing that. But driving it to the overall process that you want to achieve and the client experience you want to deliver, right? So that is really, really critical. Because as I said, you can go and build a whole heap of processes. So I'll give an example that we built out some of our processes and in conjunction with a partner organization, and they built it out for an individual, but it didn't work for a couple.
There you go.
Right? And you're sort of going, guys, like, we're not asking those right questions early enough in the journey.
And you've got to tackle problems that are right in front of your nose. I remember when we've got automation in by other business in my lending business, and we would read someone's mobile number. So most people think mobile numbers are easy to read, you know, 04, blah, 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 blah. How do you type a mobile in? Do you do the first four, then a gap?
Yeah.
Three, then three?
Yep.
Cool. Do you do 614? Do you just do four? Do you do them all the way through? There's about 30 variations of how people type their thing, which means the one bot can't do it. You've got to do 30 things.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to make people's life easy, and sending a memo out saying, hey, everyone change your behavior to just do this, is not going to cut it.
Well, even that aspect. So you go, even if you've got people to do it from then onwards, you've still got the legacy data issue.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's right. I remember being in financial planning in Sydney and all the phone numbers were two. And then they realized if they just chucked a nine in front, they could get like two million more numbers. But then all the other numbers you had to go through and add a nine.
Yeah. But even if you're thinking about that, if you go, okay, it starts with a two. So you build your process around that and you expand into Victoria.
Yeah.
And you say, well, my whole process is built around two at the start. If that doesn't exist anymore, or it's a different, you've got to build something new into that process. So, you know, things like RPA, it's thinking about that modular element to it of the different skills and how you stitch those skills together in order to deliver a process.
The elephant in the room is also, so what are the steps that you think the listeners need to, are non-negotiable? If you're out there and you know, you're being sold by your IT provider, all these things, what are the two or three things that you think need to be non-negotiable?
Yeah, so the data privacy piece, that is absolutely critical. And, you know, we are very, you know, being a larger organization, we have individuals in that business that can assess that for us. So if you're a smaller practice, it's about who are you partnering with to deliver that capacity if you don't have those skills internally.
What would be the minimum standards you'd recommend?
So
would you, I mean, as far as the data security, as far as ISO or SOC 2 or
yeah,
like what are the minimum standards that you...
For us, it's SOC 2.
Yeah.
Right? That's our starting point.
Yeah.
Right? That, and, you know, when we were validating file note providers and those types of things, SOC 2 was a critical part of that.
Yeah.
And obviously being part of a significantly larger organization.
That's okay. Right?
You know, those things matter.
Yeah.
And so for us, as I said, it's very much, you know, we've got the teams that will look after that aspect for us. But as I said, if you're not of a scale where you've got that internally, it's about who do you partner with to deliver that.
And now, it's not free.
Oh, absolutely.
Not free. So you've got to be putting this, you've got to have your risk management down as a percentage of your day-to-day sort of.
And doing it early.
Yeah.
Right? So there's no point going, I've built this great process down the track, and then compliance comes along, or, you know, your cybersecurity team comes along and says, doesn't work, because you've wasted that investment early on. And so it's finding the right point in the journey to engage them, because as you said, it's not free. So when do you engage them where it's viable enough, but you haven't sunk too much if things don't stand up? And obviously the licensee restrictions. So a number of licensees are putting restrictions on the tools and technology that their practices can actually utilize.
Yeah, that's right. And well, the buck stops with them, right? So yep. A shout out to all those responsible managers out there. I've done my time. I'm no longer a responsible manager. I think you before the thing, you said, oh, your house is on the line. I said, no, my wife's house is on the line. You know, the energy that I get from you and I suppose the curious nature of the way in which you're doing, I think you found a natural bedfellow as far as the problems you're looking to solve. You've got a combination of resources and, in many respects, leadership. They know that the 50,000 BHAG is not going to come from just hiring people and doing the same old. It can't.
Absolutely.
So it's a part of their business that needs to go. It's a long way from Mexico. So,
but to your point, you know, there's also the recognition of the headwinds in the industry that we can't just go on four times the people,
yeah,
right? And go, well, that's how we're going to service it. We have to be thinking about it differently, coming back to core values.
Yeah.
You know, that think differently element, that's important, right? And that's sort of demonstrated in this sort of approach to technology.
And the, you know, taking it all back to the vintage clients, so we've spoken about how you personally have come into the business. We've spoken about how your team members have come into the business. What's the legacy to the clients that you've had over the years? How did they feel anecdotally about the change?
Yeah, and look, it's really hard, right? So, you know, Dad always said at the very beginning, when I came into advice, you know more about these clients and your clients than pretty much anyone in their lives.
Yeah.
You're sometimes partners.
Right? And with health questions, you know more than you want to.
Well, but that's the point, right? You're not just the financial guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, with the wealth protection side that you've got the health components, right? You know family dynamics. You know all of this information, and it's a really trusted position, you know, and you're privileged to own those positions. And so for me, you know, I've gone from an advice-facing role to an internal role, and I've been working on that client transition, and it's not easy. You know, I had one client where I was looking to transition them, and they went, and they live out Central West, so they weren't in Forbes, they're in a different town, and they said, oh, we'll drive 6 hours to see you.
Wow.
Right? And I'm so going, yeah, how do you transition that client to someone else when they're going, I'm going to drive 6 hours each way to see you? And it's very challenging. But once again, if you've got a team around you where you have confidence in the advice they're delivering, we've got an organization where the structure of that advice delivery is consistent and repeatable so that we can understand it. I'm going to say on the repeatable element, the repetition needs to be the process.
Yeah.
It's not repetition in the advice. The advice is based on that values and goals, but we are consistently delivering the values and goals discussion to get to the advice solutions. That's the really, really critical piece here. And I think sometimes that gets lost for people.
Yeah, that's right. And you've got no chance of scaling unless you get that right, you know, because you need to, the client just sees the duck and then the business of the legs under the water, right? And so, but you need to be able to get that refined.
Yeah, but it's also, if you're truly putting clients first, we shouldn't have repetitious advice.
Yeah.
But what we can have is a repetitious process with which we deliver that advice. There's a consistency of client experience, but it's not the consistency of the client solutions that come out of it.
Ensemble's about the positive evolution of financial advice. And we spend a lot of time about the positive evolution of financial advisors and practices and licensees. But one of the blind spots, I think, and particular with COVID happening is a lot of our members and a lot of advisors are regional. You know, we took the decision next year to go on the road and we did the numbers. You know, we've got just under 11,000 advisors in Ensemble and 30% of them identify as living outside of the capital cities.
Yeah.
So it's a massive, massive cohort. So we're really, really looking forward to getting more, rolling our sleeves up, getting more involved with regional advisors and not just the IB team, but all regional advisors and getting that feedback, because I think as a lot of the people have pulled out of those regional areas, I think that there's my gut feel is there's a real desire for connectivity.
Yeah, and look, you know, it's very easy to go, well, we've got 100 plus advisors, we've got 400 team members. We're bigger than a number of licensees, right? A significant number of licensees. So, you know, in theory, we can create our own little bubble, right? And that risk exists. And it's really important that we engage with outside organizations so we get perspective on what we're doing. You know, the best ideas are not going to necessarily always come from those 400 people. There's brilliant people working in this space, and it's how do we learn from those people?
No, absolutely. And the allure of regional, especially for younger people who might be outpriced, or the big three cities on the eastern states is quite real. Look, I could keep going, Justin, and maybe I think potentially when we do our series on sort of our business advice excellence, we might get you there on a panel to compare notes with the best and brightest. But I've seen, you know, I've seen your journey. I've known you for a decade. I've seen the ups and downs of running a small business with you. We've compared notes over in our own practices and how we ran offshore. And I also believe that when we first started, we didn't get it. And that was on us. And, you know, we over time, we learnt that. We've merged our businesses. We've sold into bigger businesses. We've come through that journey. But the core driver, I believe, of yourself from the get-go stays the same. And that's all about that evolution of moving further and further towards the goals of the stakeholders.
So I have a bit of a personal philosophy. If you're not learning in what you're doing, you shouldn't be doing it, right? And so, you know, that continual change, that continual challenging the proposition of what you do, is that the right thing to be doing? How should we be doing it? Is something that we should always be doing.
Absolutely. And with that, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the entire Ensemble team, myself personally, and I'm looking forward to further adventures. Thanks very much, Justin.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.